6 o'clock, we do have a quorum. Why don't we go ahead and get started? Mr. Seawood, do you want to give us an overview?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So at our last meeting, we had a request for a discussion on sanctioned homeless encampments on city-owned property. And so we're going to do a couple of things. One, we're going to talk about sanctioned homeless encampment. What do they look like? What are some of the things you need in order to run one of those, run and operate one? And then we'll talk about city properties. So what you should have in front of you is, one, something from the unfortunately, I can't read that without my glasses.
Okay. United States Interagency Council on Homelessness.
And public health from Seattle and King County, and then a list of city properties. There was another request from Councilwoman Fowler. There were 2 pages from the It Takes a Village, and so everyone should have at least those 2 pages.
And they should have the digital copy of the entire document.
Correct.
Yes. Thank you.
So with that, we'll go ahead and let Stephanie Browning get started with the presentation on sanctioned homeless encampments.
Okay. Thank you. After the last meeting, a number of us from multiple departments came together to meet to talk about how we move forward for this discussion tonight. And so many of those people are in the room, so we have a lot of expertise in here if you have questions. So just to start with the background. I know these are all nothing new. Our recent point in time count was in 2020. That was our most recent one. And you can see the number of people in the community, 238 were identified in that count. 189 were sheltered and 49 were unsheltered. You know that the city currently provides and contracts for services, a variety of social services around this issue of homelessness. We just last council meeting, we just approved the agreement for planning a comprehensive homeless services center. And of course, I think it's important to say that, you know, we feel that families and individuals experiencing the crisis of unsheltered homelessness deserve a place, a safe place to stay as they create that path out. This is not also familiar to you. It's been a lot of presentations, but that's our point in time data. They just did. In 2021, they did not do the count because of the pandemic, but they just did it within the last 2 weeks. We won't have those results until summer. So the document that DeCarlin referred to from the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, I'm just going to hit a few of the high points of the document. One, they note that encampments don't have a lot of impact on ending homelessness in and of themselves. They can be very costly to both public and private agencies. They can be difficult to manage. Sometimes they're proposed or thought of as a temporary solution, but they have found that they can be difficult to close. And they said ultimately access to stable housing that people can afford with the right level of service to help them succeed is what ends homelessness. And I read the 56-page document that Ms. Fowler sent out today. And I think that there's a lot of things that tie into these same, you know, you can see when they talk about the case studies that, you know, the management and the setup is just really, really important. So you also have this document from Seattle and King County Public Health, who is one of those public health agencies that I have a lot of faith in. I think they do excellent work. And so they prepared a planning and management checklist for sanctioned homeless encampments. I believe that currently Seattle itself has 9 city permitted villages, so they do have a permitting process. And some of the things that the checklist covers, it's 20-some pages, but it talks about infrastructure and encampment design, water, sanitation and waste removal, food handling and meal planning processes, policies around how pets are handled, resident safety policies, and ongoing staff and management structure. as we talked amongst staff, we talked about some of those considerations as well, that any, wherever, if there was to be a sanctioned encampment, I think things we have to think about is like the proximity to reliable transportation, you know, transit services. Again, that infrastructure and encampment design. Sanitation, I think, is going to be essential. And that's not only the water, wastewater, you know, our waste removal, but cleanings, hygiene supplies, those kinds of things. A lot of information in the document Ms. Fowler sent out today talked about how they set up safety policies in some of those case studies as well. You know, is there going to be electricity? How will the premises be secured? I think you would want to think about something, you know, like proximity to jobs and social service agencies is being vital, because, you know, sometimes people make the assumption that homeless people don't work. But the reality is, if anybody that's been out at Ratty knows, people get up every morning and they go to work. So, you know, that siting would be very important. Of course, being a department that has animal control, I always think about pet management and some of the issues that could arise there. And, of course, wherever it is, you'd want to have neighborhood or the support of people that are in the surrounding area. Sarah Perry from our risk management department, we asked what kind of risks the city could face. And so basically she had these three points that, you know, an encampment, a sanctioned encampment equates an invitation for use. And so that means that the city would have responsibilities such as security services, utilities, etc., unless it was transferred by contractual agreement to a third party. She said that a sanctioned camp on city property increases the responsibility for all parties, especially in areas with mixed users of the area. And lastly, you know, we are self-insured, so any potential claims or losses would be charged to our self-insurance until the cost exceeded our retention or deductible. And that could affect future premiums. So some of the things I think as we discuss this tonight, you know, one, is this something that the city wants to do? Should the city pursue other options as part of that homeless services planning process? I think that, you know, what I read today that Ms. Fowler sent, you know, they talked about how in setting up in some of these camps up in the Northwest, mostly up in the Pacific Northwest, the kinds of processes and community engagement processes that they had with people when they were going to neighbors and businesses in the area. So, you know, I think we would need to do some really robust engagement. We would definitely have to develop a budget. I don't think, until I read the article today, I think a budget would be very important, because I think it could be very costly. And then, you know, we have options. We could talk about searching for, like, doing a contract with a local organization that may want to provide support to an encampment. And then, of course, we have Kale here. We, you know, I think you all remember that very beginning of the pandemic, we did issue an RFP to try to create sanctioned or a site for people that could be housed safely for our unsheltered. And so we could go back and relook at that. Some of the things that, you know, we need, if we were going to do that, we need to revisit the scope of services. You know, where would the site be? What we had before was for up to 70 people in 16x16 campsites, and it required potable water, refuse receptacles and disposal, portable toilets and hand washing station, and then we also had in there some training for staff and volunteers. So any revisions we, you know, Kale would need if that was a route that you wanted to go. We did not get anyone that applied or was willing to do that 2 years ago. I'll turn it over to Mike now.
Thank you, Stephanie. When I offered to help do this, a lot of it is because there's a lot of park property, you know, so a lot of the property's there's a lot. And so basically, we found about 146 sites that have enough space, because when you count 70 spaces, 16 by 16, and then you need space for dumpsters, you know, storage, etc. It really comes up to be anywhere between an acre or so, and a little larger maybe, because you're never going to find a flat, perfect terrain. You know, having a flat soccer field somewhere would be ideal, but again, that's another issue there as well. And so what we've tried to do is look at the property, and we can't really show it on a map, one single map, so we broke it down by wards so you could see each one. And so this first one is one that our park planners generated. And as you can see, it shows all the sites, and you're going to see a lot more, like it said, it'll say the, all the property, but it'll say something like Parks and Rec has 23 sites. Well, what this is done is by lot. For example, Cosmo Park is really almost like 13 lots. Even though we call it one park, because of the legal lot issue, it's counted as 13. So you're going to see a lot of that. But the problem with this map is it also shows all the issues, like it has the armory, it has Field Park, it has some land like with the school, like Agin Street, like our Agin Park, Packwood, that's on property that's not owned by us, that we've been given a cooperative agreement to have a park on. And so you see some of that. So we started looking at that and saying, well, you know, we need to look at this a little closer, because it also doesn't take topography. You know, like, what's the trees? Where's the lakes at? You know, is it a steep slope? Is it flat? What are that? So we went with GIS, started talking to those guys, and they were able to do a lot of remarkable stuff. They were able to get into it, go through it, look at it. And so then this is the map they prepared. And, of course, as you can see, they've got the roads on there. They've got it right now. They've got, like, ramps onto the interstate. They've got the city parks, and then they've got it down by the colors for the wards. So what we're really looking for is the blue areas. That's the land where they were able to find out that there's no heavily trees, it's more open space, where it's at. So for example, in the last map, where we showed downtown Optimus Park as a site, this map doesn't show that as a site because it's too small and it's not really appropriate for, it would not hold that many campsites on it. And so it takes all those off, so you can really see it kind of concentrates on Clary Shy, where the Ark's located, Lion Stevens. Well, that's just kind of outside the ward there, but for First Ward, that is. So it does it, you know, kind of goes to Douglas, shows that. And again, Douglas, though, is partially on school, you know, so a lot of that park is owned by the school district. And so we have those issues there as well. All right, so then we did the same thing. Here's Second Ward. You know, with the parks and everything locked there, you can see that there's, it shows here, because again, the lots, it shows 51. We know we don't have that many, and this is in the second ward, but it's got public works, so the sewer utilities, got 7, stormwater, water life, these are all sites in the city. And then when you go back to the GIS map, now you can see, for example, in Cosmo Park, all the blue area are the land where there's no trees. So you can see how heavily the athletic fields are located. The golf course is located on there as a potential open space area, as well as we get down to here. See, right there, that's off Strawn Road by Strawn Park. That's the old Potterfield track. And that was one of the sites that we proposed a couple years ago as a possible site. If, say, somebody presented a proposal, we didn't call it out in the RFP, but we gave that as a possible site if they wanted to use it for the RFP, because it does have water, it does have it's not very flat though, and it's of course not close to any public transportation. It's not downtown or anything like that. And again, here's a third ward. Again, Stevens Lake Park shown and all the golf course. And then of course you look at the blue map, you know, where you see all the open space, you can see all the areas that are highlighted, the options that are there. Fourth ward, same thing. You know, this is the one our park planners did. Easier to read, but it doesn't really get into the details we need. And so here we have all the and of course, in this area here, and if you have questions about that, a lot of that is Dave Sorrell's, and he's got restrictions on the sewer utility and all that. That, you know, all these, just because they're shown doesn't mean they're allowable. It just means that they're right now, they're open space. They could certainly accommodate it if needed. And here we are at sixth ward, and then our fifth ward, and then here's the map for fifth ward. And finally, Sixth Ward, you know, the Gans Creek Recreation Area, again, you can see it looks like the whole site's available, but really when you look at the blue, there, you've got the Gans Creek runs through it, heavily trees, very steep topography, so you can kind of see how the maps are located on that. So the list here is, we thought maybe a list would be easier to read, but the problem was we can't generate addresses. Because a lot of the sites don't have addresses. They're like buffer land, like they're MKT Trail buffer land or they're Colt Railroad buffer land. So it's not like we can go by address. We would just have to look at individual sites to do it. And so that was difficult trying to find a decent way to share all this except for these map issues. So really that's all I have, and I'll turn it back over to Carlin for questions or discussion.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Griggs, your whole list of park stuff are the ones you have here listed large enough and flat enough, or is this just a
no? This is list? This represents the land that was shown on the GIS maps. It should be eligible.
Okay.
So
we don't have a list that's, or maybe I should ask Mr. Seaward this. Do we have a list that is actually what city property is owned that's more than 1 acre that's flat enough? I mean, have we gone
that would
through
be, that? I'm sorry, that is the answer to the question. Okay. This is that list, but it doesn't have by address.
Okay, yeah, I don't care about
the address.
Because
some of these are not defined as well. Sorry, okay. I didn't do a good job answering
that. That's okay,
question.
I probably didn't do a good job asking the question. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions?
I have a couple of questions. Dr. Browning, at the beginning of the pandemic, I recall, I think I was in the room, when you and Steve talked about going out and buying every tent and sleeping bag you could find. Yes, I was in the room when you did that. Steve Hollis went out and bought tents and... Did you not buy tents and sleeping bags, Steve?
No, Phoenix did not have the street outreach team.
So, but were you part of that purchase? Were you out there looking for stuff? Oh my goodness, that's not what I recall at all. So where were those folks going to go with those tents and those sleeping bags?
So Phoenix is the physical agent of sorts for the street outreach team. That is something that they do on an ongoing and regular basis. Providing street outreach supplies for a number of years.
Are you not part of the street outreach team? Interesting. So we have a number of people that are already living in tents and would benefit from the provision of water and even trash pickup. So, and there's other services. Clearly, this is not the optimal solution, but it doesn't appear that there are optimal solutions in the immediate short term. For not only the folks that are already camping somewhere, but for the folks that will then no longer have a place to sleep at night when Room at the Inn closes this Saturday morning. So what do you propose for those individuals?
Do you have any thoughts?
As far as like supplies?
Where are they supposed to go?
So, I don't have a plan for that. We've kept this every single year. In my career, we've added services. You know, early in my career, there was no winter shelter. There was no proper drop-in center. There was no street outreach team. So we worked really hard to build those, but it's still not enough. I mean, we sit here today without a great solution. Once again, coming out of winter, even right at the end, it used to start after the holidays. February, you tacked on a month at the beginning and usually about 2 or 3 weeks at the end. So it's been an evolution. I think the biggest challenge is there's no money. All of that has been done as part of the zero sum. It's a really complex partnership. The city plays a role, but certainly not the only role.
Well, I think there are organizations out there, including Love Columbia is paying for a number of hotel rooms. Yes, and so they have been able to shelter homeless families to make sure the children can get on a school bus and go to school in the morning. So what my concern is that we know that there are folks already living not only on the sidewalk, but we'll be adding to those numbers probably 45 people or so who regularly attend RADI, and then the folks that are living in the woods. So knowing that they would benefit from services like portable toilets and water and trash collection, what is our responsibility as a community to assist them when we don't have other options for them?
That's a good question. That's not an easy one. No, it's those things where, if you look at, you know, what should the city be doing? It's to try to provide the service that we can't provide. Right now, we have a planning proposal that's being developed by the Housing Authority, Loaves and Fishes, VAC, Turning Point, and those are the agencies that provide those critical services. And so partnering with the people who are doing it, I think that's how we're going to be successful. Now, the one thing that I'm afraid of is we've been putting a lot of patches, and when we put a patch, there's this unintended consequences that occurs, and it's like, well, how do we fix that? And then we put another patch, and then there's another unintended consequences. And so whatever we do, we have to make sure that it's planned correctly, that we have the defined goals, that we know exactly what we're trying to obtain, and then that will help us develop whatever the program is. And so if the idea is that we want to do some type of encampment, I can't say that we'll be prepared to do an encampment for this upcoming spring, because we haven't planned it out. We haven't actually looked at exactly what it needs in order to be successful. We haven't talked to anyone who's running an encampment to say, okay, what are the things that are the pitfalls that we may fall into if we're not correcting our processes. And so from whatever process comes from this, it's going to have to be well planned out. And we're going to have to make sure that we rely on our partners who are providing these critical services in order for us to be successful.
So, Mr. DeCarlin, with us tonight are several people who are out there as volunteers providing what they can to folks that are living in the woods and sleeping on the sidewalk. So when we know that incrementally we could improve what's already happening out there by regular trash service, by perhaps talking with the property owners, I understand the police know mostly where the camps are. That's what I hear. I don't know where Chief Jones
is, Chief Jones is right there.
The folks in one of the camps said, oh, the police know where they are. They come by and we talk to them. And because he said, and he also said something about trash service. And I said, well, wouldn't that disclose where you are? And they said, they already know where we are, but it would be helpful if we had trash service. And we had these other services that would make a bad situation incrementally better while we're trying to plan. You know, ultimately, the goal is stable housing for each
Absolutely.
And every person.
Absolutely.
But in the meantime, we know there are people that have to sleep on the sidewalk, and that number will grow as of this Saturday morning. So is the city willing to incrementally provide assistance to the places where the camps are now so that we can improve some of the conditions for them?
I don't know what are you asking us to do?
Trash service. One of the complaints that we hear from property owners and neighbors is there's trash wherever the camps are. Well, there's no place for them to throw their trash, and never mind the pay-as-you-throw system. There's nobody that comes by and collects the trash. When the volunteers go out and help clean up, we have to tote all that trash with us somewhere. So would the city be able to provide regular trash service for places so that we can, the people that are in the camps can help keep them visually in better condition?
A second suggestion would be contracting with a company that does portable toilet service to place portable toilets at or near these locations to improve the conditions for the people living there.
Are these on, is this private property, or is this MoDOT property, or is it city property, or?
It varies. There's not just one camp. People are spread out.
So if they're on private property, I would think we would have to check with the property owner as far as putting toilets or anything else out there.
Of course.
But do you know where the city property is that they're on? And I know MoDOT has cleaned out the homeless shelters under the bridges. Was it in December? They came through and did that because there was a lot of trash from that. But do we know? I guess the chief knows where these are.
Well, those, I don't think it's a good idea for us to, with all the people present here, to talk about where the camps are located. But they are scattered throughout the area, and people are sleeping there. And people have pets, and they have family members, and they're trying to do the best they can.
Right.
So I don't have a list. I've not been to all the camps. I have visited one camp, and I helped them move when they were pushed off the land by the property owner. So I can't answer your question, Betsy,
okay.
And I don't think it's appropriate for us to answer that here.
You think they're in danger if somebody knows where the camps are?
Well, you know, when you are... It's clear we don't have a place for them.
Right.
And so they're doing the best they can under very difficult circumstances to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a good idea for us to draw attention to that, given that we don't have any willingness so far, I'm hoping we get some willingness tonight, to provide them with any assistance. I don't know the answer to your question, but I'm not going to turn around and ask our folks here to identify where the camps are right now. But so if we start with trash service, could we make arrangements to pick up trash from those locations where people are camping? Because we're going to have 40 to 50 new campers as of Saturday.
Well, it depends. I mean, I need to talk to Dave Sorrell to see exactly where the trash routes are, and if it's on the curb or it's on a route where the truck is going by, then that's easier. If it's asking our solid waste guys to go into the woods to locate a location, that's
difficult. They would bring it out to the curb. They just would like to know that it would be picked up wherever the closest street is. Could we arrange for that? Would the city be willing to do that?
I can't say definitively yes, we will do it. I think that's something we can look at.
So alternatively, could we arrange, I know that you're short on staff to deliver, but could we arrange for dumpsters in certain locations so that they can keep their...
Who's paying for all this?
Well, and that was going to be the thing is, if we give dumpsters, now that's asking the council to waive those fees.
It's asking all the other ratepayers to pay them.
Yes, sir.
I have a question that's really probably for Steve. Steve, can you tell us more about the street outreach team, how they're funded, and the work they do, and whether this additional service that we're talking about for the camps is something that, if we could find funding, that we could expand the role of the street outreach team to do some of this work?
Can I interrupt you for just a minute? Would you mind, if we're going to inquire of Steve Hollis, that he join us at
the
table?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, sir, I don't remember your name, but if I could have that chair for Steve Hollis to join us at the table, please. I noticed an eighth council member.
Well, we're expanding.
So, Councilperson Thomas, to address your question, I think it's important to understand the street outreach team is not an official thing. So
okay.
it is very much a collaboration. It stemmed from years ago. Actually, the director of the library called me, my old friend Melissa Carr, and said, what can we do about the homeless folks in the library? At that time, Phoenix Programs was receiving what's called ESG funding, Emergency Solutions Grant, now in the amount of $50,000 for street outreach. That frankly was not happening very, very regularly. So I worked with Phoenix first, and then we started to partner with other organizations like VA, who is becoming very interested in homelessness, Burl Behavioral Health, which doesn't actually have a technical role, especially at that time, in addressing homelessness, but it was certainly was within their mission because so many of the folks experience chronic mental illness. And then the other agency that is funded to do street outreach is New Horizons. They receive a grant from Department of Mental Health called the PATH grant. So there are really only two agencies that are actually paid to do street outreach. It's Phoenix through federal funds via the state, and New Horizons via state funds, Department of Mental Health. What we do, and which is pretty typical and pretty unusual about this city government, is that we try to put all that together. And a lot of my job is just relationship-based and putting things together to try to solve issues and problems. It went well. I think they saw some benefits of safety, coordination, and collaboration. Katie Burnham Wilkins, who many of you know that was at the VA, really kind of served as the unofficial lead for some time. They met, and then eventually that also is a key part of our coordinated entry process. So it's part of identifying and staying in touch with the folks, particularly the experience on sheltered homelessness. And so that's kind of how that works. They go out individually, but they all go out as a team, typically on Fridays together and hit the main camps, and it's the same camps that mobile soup kitchen's aware of. The camps can vary pretty greatly from day to day. There's certainly some more established camps. I know one thing, when Leland was here, I talked to Leland about the Solid Waste District. One big issue we had was when these property owners have these camps, the cleanup can be pretty costly. And one of the things, when Leland was still here, we discussed is could there be some sort of fund to help the property owner, because it can be pretty expensive. That's one idea we've kicked around. Leland, as you guys know, went to Ashland and didn't quite finish that discussion. The street outreach team does take supplies out. They typically use grant funds. Councilperson Fowler, I think you're probably thinking of early in the pandemic, we actually provide additional Como Helps funds to Phoenix on behalf of the street outreach team to try to acquire additional tents. At that time, the big fear and concern was that the shelters were going to shut down because that was happening all over the country. So we're really just trying to stock up and be prepared in case we couldn't have folks, as many folks in shelter. We were really lucky. Shelters worked really hard. We provided a tremendous amount of guidance and support. We actually were able to keep our shelters open here throughout the pandemic, which is pretty unusual. So that's a quick kind of history and overview of the street outreach team. We don't actually fund the street outreach team as a city. Just work closely with them.
So are there any toilet facilities at the camps?
No, the closest I think we've come is during the pandemic. We actually paid for toilet or porta potties at Turning Point, and then up at Phoenix. Actually, I worked with Phoenix to have some because it's up north, close to some of those camps are. It's a challenge, even at Wabash. We've had some real challenges with the porta potties to the extent that we've had providers say we're pulling this porta potty. I think at one point, if I'm not mistaken, they said they weren't going to service the contract any longer. It's a challenge. The deal with sharps and just issues. I know I went to Wabash last winter and cleaned one myself because they said they were going to shut
it down. And that's very much appreciated.
It's a challenge. The parks help a lot when the weather's good, but the winter's tough, and I might can speak to that because of water issues. The sanitation and the trash is just a huge issue in the camps, just like it is in every community that deals with these issues. Trash is tough. Chief Jones can speak to this. One of the big challenges when it's on private property is that you need to get permission, especially for city officials. That's a huge issue, is that a lot of it's on private property. If it's on public property, it tends to be that it winds up getting vacated. We really have had great experience with Public Works, with the park staff, with the police on providing notice to folks. We post, the street outreach team gives plenty of notice. They go out and really try to work hard with folks if we know a camp is going to be vacated. It's actually a similar process that MoDOT used. I'd say some of the most challenging situations are the ones on private property. It's technically, especially if you're acting in an official capacity, you really need explicit permission from the landowner to be there. It's challenging. I want to go back to the point time count. And my recollection, first week I was elected, Steve Hollis, your team met with me about that point time count. My recollection was you tend to rank those individuals based on motivation, desire to receive services, that type of thing. I noticed our count here is some of the lowest it's been since 2017. So of that 238, what's your sense of how many desire to receive services, are motivated for alcohol and drug treatment, or that type of thing? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, just one quick point. The point time count's been around a long time, and what's different lately is, to some degree, I think we're talking about what we call coordinated entry process. So the point time count is literally just a snapshot of one day of year. What's really different in the last 5 years or so is that we keep a program we call a prioritization list, by name list, and if they're willing, then they're ranked by risk. And really what you're looking for is their risk of dying on the street based on a variety of factors. The list of unsheltered folks is somewhat static. What we're seeing lately, the biggest issue that we see now is we have about 100 housing choice vouchers that have been assigned to folks, and we simply cannot find housing for them to take the vouchers. So that's a bit of a way to answer your question. There are certainly folks that are not ready for housing, whether it's by choice or because of the severity, in many cases, of the mental illness and just barriers. Typically, we see a lot of interest and willingness to get into housing. It's dynamic. There's usually about 50, I'm just going to put this out there based on my experience as doing this for a long time. It's about 50-ish, if you look over the period of time, unsheltered folks that are pretty tough to house.
Chronically homeless.
Chronically homeless folks with a variety of issues, pretty significant barriers, even if they want to get housed, whether it's no credit, criminal histories, things like that. In my professional experience doing this about 26 years now, that's kind of the number we work with. I have a feeling, though, because we just did the count, I think our unsheltered count's going to be a little higher this winter. I do think that the pandemic exacerbated some of our numbers. I want to say this very carefully, because in the past I've not liked this idea. I will say we are seeing some migration here because of the services we offer. Traditionally, we've seen a lot of rural sheriff's departments drop people here. I will say lately, we are seeing a pretty significant migration from Kansas City to St. Louis. And what they are saying is, I was told to come here because you have services. I think it's a societal issue. I think we are developing little city states, in my personal opinion, resources, places where there are resources and resource deserts. And I do think we're seeing a little bit of that. I can tell you the providers feel pretty overwhelmed by the numbers now. Even with the help of advocates and volunteers, the numbers feel a little bigger lately.
So how much excess capacity, Director Browning, does your department have to handle the current point in time data and the named list?
Well, I mean, it's something Steve coordinates every year with our partners.
Yeah, we really play more of a convening role.
Yeah.
The need definitely exceeds our resources. Even just trying to case manage folks.
Would a sanctioned camp make your capacity better or worse, and would it make the migration better or worse?
Well, I think it could increase the migration. I do think that people, I mean, we had but a couple months ago, someone dropped off here in town by the sheriff's department because they thought we had isolation services for the homeless. I think people would, theoretically, more people would come, and probably the biggest risk there is our social service agencies are pretty stretched thin right now. And so if all of a sudden we had double the people, it's going to make it harder
Everyone struggles. This is a huge issue.
But if we were to allocate resources from, for example, the American Rescue Plan Act funds, then your department, as you've already proposed for the community engagement process, and social service agencies potentially could add staff, add capacity, and be able to meet those service needs.
Sure, yes. And we can't, ARPA is very clear, you can't use it for non-congregate settings.
Correct.
So, yeah, so I mean.
You can't use it for
non-congregate
settings.
Is that right?
That's correct.
You can't use it for congregate
settings. You cannot use it.
So what you can fund a drop-in center if it's part of a facility that has separate bedrooms. But you cannot just fund a drop-in center.
Like a shelter.
So you can't fund a shelter with ARPA funds?
No.
You can form a shelter like Room at the Inn where you're providing separate bedrooms for families.
Yeah,
well, Room at the Inn doesn't provide separate bedrooms. It's in one large gymnasium.
Usually. Okay, not Room at the Inn. I'm sorry. I meant the Welcome Inn. But you could not fund just a drop-in facility. If you're going to use ARPA funds, it has to have those bedroom components surrounding. But if you have the bedroom components surrounding, you could have a separate room within that facility.
But it sounds like you're saying we cannot use ARPA funds to support Room at the Inn as it's currently organized.
Correct, and we haven't been using.
We haven't used it for anything yet, but I didn't realize that was prohibited.
Yeah, that wasn't part of the thought.
I have a question about this dropping off.
I'm sorry, hang on, Schmidt. Dr. Peters, did you have another question?
I just had a question as to whether there were sanctioned homeless or sanctioned whatever places in Kansas City, St. Louis, or Springfield? I mean, do we have this in other places?
I'm not aware of any in Missouri.
Would we be the first?
I believe so.
Okay. That was just my question. So
my question about law enforcement dropping off, where is the chief? Hello, chief. The question about law enforcement dropping people off in Columbia, is there a relationship or a custom where they let you know that they're coming here to drop somebody off?
Director Griggs, do you ever have
I'm sorry, I wasn't off? Done asking.
Do you ever have people drop off?
Yeah, we had a county deputy call to complain that the ARC was closed one day during a snowstorm, and he had someone to drop off. So I gave him Ratty's contact information.
So as a follow-up to the chief, is there a possibility for your department or MUPD or the Boone County Sheriff's Department to have a relationship with Missouri Psychiatric Center so that you know that somebody has brought that person in so that we could then return them or work through channels so that they would go back to the community they're from?
So that relationship would be more likely established through work. I have had conversations.
So how long have we as city government known about this practice?
I've inquired whether or not people were being transported within the last month, whether they've taken back.
So is it just anecdotal information that you find? I mean, I hear this hesitation that if we provide humane services to the people we have, we're going to attract more people. But that still doesn't take off of our plate the fact that we have people living in the woods without appropriate sanitation. And we know they're there. And even though there's a percentage of them that would like to have housing, we don't have housing to offer them. And so I have a math problem with this, and I don't mean to diminish the fact that we're talking about real human beings, but we have only so many services. We know there's only so many services. We know that the organizations are doing their best to find additional housing, yet we still have 150 or 189 people that don't have shelter, and we know it, but we're frozen in doing something about it because we can't do it perfectly.
Further questions?
I don't think we're frozen. I do think we're lacking a way forward. And I think most folks are trying to pull in the same direction to get some of this accomplished. There have been difficulties in the past, no question about it. There were other kinds of complications like migration and all of these other factors that are affecting this. What we need is a comprehensive approach to this so that we don't face this again next year. We may not have enough time this year to solve this problem by March or April or whenever, whatever date it is. We've kicked around ideas about an encampment. As I can recall, maybe a year or two ago, something about Cosmo Park, for example, that was not a viable option because transportation was not available and it was public property and there were federal guidelines that we would have to forego with the kinds of complications that would occur here. There are 50 people or so out there, and you may be right, Ms. Fowler, there may be a few more after March. Some of those people, I don't know how many, maybe half or maybe a quarter of them, simply will not take advantage of any services that we can offer, even if we could offer them. Some of them will. And we've made some great strides, I think, for some folks in terms of housing, affordable housing. And we can kick around lots of other ideas about Mr. Thomas's idea about inclusionary zoning for as far as that goes, and all kinds of changes that might occur to our zoning codes to help this situation out. But for right now, we're kind of stuck. But what we need is some information to relieve some of these problems, not hopefully in the short term, but certainly in the long term. And that's what I'm looking toward. I'm looking towards the kind of information that we can make reasonable decisions to make sure that we can reduce this problem in the future, even if we cannot eliminate it.
So, Mr. Scala, help me understand how we know that there are
people
out there.
I'm not sure I'm going to have a colloquy here with you.
But you made a statement that there are people that absolutely don't want to have
I think
services.
There are some folks that absolutely do not. And, you know, when we talk about zero-tolerance shelters, I prefer the term low-tolerance shelters because zero-tolerance, it's kind of an absolute statement. And I don't quite understand, as a psychologist, I don't quite understand what that means. But I certainly think that anyone in need of help and the largesse that the city may have and can extend and should extend, I think it's beholden on us to make sure that we understand what some of these problems are in order to help some of these folks out. Some folks simply don't want that help. They just don't want it for whatever reason. Maybe it's an issue with addiction. Maybe it's an issue with their philosophy. I don't know. But I think there are folks out there who simply will not accept help, even if it's offered to them. We have to figure out what the best way is to serve most of the people most of the time, even in this unique group.
Any further discussion? Mr.
I had a couple questions for Mr. Hollis. You mentioned, I think, 100 housing vouchers that were, I'm not sure the word you used, not being used. Mm-hmm. Is that because there are not 100 vacant units available?
I wouldn't say that. It's really more just the issue of getting property owners to accept the vouchers or the people that have them. It's an issue. We're working on a proposal. There are some communities that are working on this very issue of trying to increase access to the housing stock that's available, their incentives and things like that. But it is folks that have, you know, many of them have zero credit history, criminal history, and in a college town like this, repeatedly we see that they can either rent to somebody like that or free college students. You know, I would say, if you ask the provider community, the Functional Zero Task Force, which is what sits down every 2 weeks to try to house folks, it's literally what we do, try to house folks on the list. That is a growing issue. It's already been tough. Everybody in this room, I think, knows we have an affordable housing issue. That has gotten worse, I think. There aren't enough vouchers, it's a bit of a market issue, I really. I mean, if you have a shortage of housing and you're a property owner, who are you going to rent to? I mean, it's really that kind of simple.
And didn't we used to have a downtown-specific outreach unit?
So I believe the district still has a contract, the downtown district, with 4A Change.
Okay.
And John Trapp does work with the street outreach team. Yeah, he also works over at the inn. There is coordination, but yes, there is specific outreach for downtown, as I understand it, paid for by the district.
Okay, but there's no, the city doesn't have any involvement in that specifically. And then the street outreach unit that you were talking about earlier, not sure exactly what I'm asking, but how many people do you think, you know, they are servicing or helping on a regular basis? I don't mean making contact with, but
The best measure of that is what's so different than the point in time count was a snapshot, is that we have a list by name of people on an ongoing basis that's updated as best as possible. And it's hovering around 150. And that's sheltered and unsheltered, by the way, because we want to move people out of shelters into housing as well. So it tends to hover around that 150 number. You don't have to engage. It's all by client permission. So the number you see is a decent idea in the winter. It's important to note that our numbers do tend to go down a bit in the summer. Obviously, our sheltered counts go down a bit and our unsheltered go up. It's not perfect. It's one of the better ones in the state. There's a big population we haven't talked about, and that's folks living in their cars. They are considered unsheltered, but they're hard to find because they're not in camps. They're mobile. And that's an issue all over the country. The other huge population are folks that are doubled up with other folks and living in hotels. They're actually not considered homeless by HUD. They're technically not considered homeless. I would say that pretty consistently, though, our by-name list, meaning they're engaged and willing to work, is about 150.
And how many people sort of move off that list? What's the trend?
I don't have that data with me tonight. We do track the data. It's not perfect, as you might imagine. I would say what we call that is inflow and outflow. And I would say in the last year or two, our outflow is not as great as our inflow. We are seeing an increase.
Okay.
I don't think that's unusual. I'm sure you've heard that in the media. That housing stability is just a growing issue.
Okay, thanks.
So you can see here, though, our efforts, though, we've been able to maintain a fairly flat line because that inflow and that outflow has been fairly good. I'd say it's getting worse in the last year.
Do you have another question?
I just had a comment. It seems like before we've talked about needing to get someone to oversee this whole sort of continuum of homelessness to shelter to transitional housing to house, you know, that, you know, Randy works on this part, you work on that part. I mean, everybody's, you know, got part of the elephant or whatever you want, but that perhaps we need to once again visit that. It's not going to address a sanctioned camp right at this moment, so I don't want to go on much longer, but just that we maybe need to think about a position that would actually be able to tie all these together versus the sort of in the street, you know, knowing people one at a time.
Mr. Thomas.
I just wanted to endorse your point, Carl, that a long-term approach is necessary for this. And I don't think the city council works at its best when we react very quickly to rapidly changing, you know, situations. I think sometimes it's very valid that we try, but I think our greatest strength is to be able to give sort of high-level direction over long-term. And I'm hoping that, you know, we can demonstrate the political will right now that we really want to put resources into this problem, as heartbreaking and desperate as it is, to figure out a solution. And we have some, you know, very capable professional staff in our organization, our partners' organizations. So I would ask that, you know, we continue to develop these plans. The planning grant for Columbia Housing Authority for the Services Center is great, but can we develop a bold plan for, you know, unsheltered homeless in the shorter term? And then it'll be a political decision whether we want to allocate public funds to address it.
We'll meet in the next room in 5 minutes. 4 minutes.